The front door opens now, and a man and a woman step out, pushing a pram. I look behind them for a moment into an open plan extension where our kitchen used to be. The man regards me with suspicion, and I stand, an intruder in my own past. I think of our life there, all the days and nights since, the weeks, the months, the years. I think of time and how it passes.
That's actor Gabriel Byrne reading an excerpt from his memoir, Walking with Ghosts. Gabriel has starred in more than 80 films over his illustrious career. He's also appeared on Broadway. In Walking with Ghosts, Gabriel revisits different moments in his life, including his childhood growing up just outside Dublin. His poetic prose takes us on a journey from a sensitive child to an acclaimed actor on screen and on stage. We zoomed in with Gabriel from his home in Maine to find out about the trials and tribulations of his life, his vivid imagination, and his love of verse.
I've found that I have a tendency often to live in the future, and not so much now, but in past times, to live in the past. Neither are real. The only thing that's real is the present. If you live in fear of the future and you live in regret of the past, you're essentially living in a place that is not good for the soul.
Mm-hmm. Yes, very well said. It's your mom's favorite quote, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yes. I didn't really hear it until, you know, as is the way with parents, they go on and on like a radio in the background. And then when they pass away, you suddenly remember, oh, yeah, that means something. My mother used to always quote the Scottish poet, Robbie Burns, "Oh, to have the power to see ourselves as others see us." And she would always say that. And it's only recently, well, at least in the last 10 or 15 years, that I suddenly thought about that quote and remembered it and remembered the truth of it. Hmm. So both those quotations are in my head.
Mm-hmm. When you were a boy, you decided to become a priest and you left Ireland and your family to attend a seminary in England. And you ended up having a very traumatic experience at the seminary. Can you tell us about what happened?
Well, basically, these priests came to the school and said, look, here's some photographs and slides. And, you know, would you like to have a life like this, flying in small planes and going up rivers? And so they appealed to the imagination. They appeal to our child's desire for adventure, but also, I think, in a subtle kind of way, our child's discontent with the present and our desire to be somewhere else. And my parents were very devout Catholics. They didn't see anything wrong with this. Religion was paramount in terms of how people live their lives in Ireland at that time. Yeah, so I went to this seminary in England, which was a completely different country. And the atmosphere favored secrecy that protected the priests. And quite a few of the students there were sexually abused by these priests, and amongst them myself. And I made contact with this priest many, many years later, maybe 40 years later. And I asked him, he was in a retirement home. And I asked him if he remembered me. And he said, no, he had no memory of me. And I remember thinking to myself, well, that is a stunning thing to take on board, that something that I've remembered all my life, he had no memory of. And I had lifted the phone to him with the intention of confronting him with his crime, actually. And I couldn't do it. And what it led me to was the realization that we all expect that life will deliver resolution, and that the confrontation with the source will result in a moving on, what they call closure now. But life isn't like that. Souls, and these are one of the ghosts that I talk about that walk with you through your life. But that doesn't mean that my life was desperately unhappy because of that. It wasn't. I'm very lucky in the sense that I did survive, but I know other people who didn't.
Yeah, I'm sorry you had to experience that. That's a terrible thing to have to go through, especially at the age of 11. Do you think that being an actor has helped you escape from the traumatic experiences that you've endured during the early years of your life?
I don't think so, is the honest answer to that. I mean, I don't think there's anything mystical or deep about acting. Some people know how to do it. Some people don't. Some people are great at it. Some people are really good at it. Some people are okay at it. To me, it's a wonderful way to express yourself. But it ends at 5 o'clock when they say wrap. You know, young actors will say, do you have any advice? And it's the advice that, you know, I've learned myself. I don't have a great deal of advice to give about anything, but in relation to acting, and I think it's true of other things too, don't confuse work for life, because it's not. It's a job. And nobody ever lay on their deathbed and said, God, I wish I'd done that movie with George Clooney. For people in the business that I'm in can sometimes get reversed, and people can think that the only thing that's important is fame, money, and prestige. And actually, they are very, very illusory ambitions.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe what it was like for you to see yourself acting on screen for the very first time?
Well, let me ask you this question.
Okay.
Maybe some of your listeners. Have you ever listened to your voice on tape?
Oh, yes.
Now, what do you think of your voice on tape?
Yeah, when I hear it on tape, not a fan of my voice.
Most people are like that. Most people go, oh my God, do I actually sound like that? What about if you see yourself on a video?
Same deal, yeah. Not happy with how I come across.
Well, that's the way it kind of is. No more complicated or simpler than that. Many, many, many actors that I know have exactly the same problem. They never see anything that they do. They never listen to anything that they do, because it's a fragile thing to reconcile your inner and your outer self.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, one of your first breakthrough performances was in the TV miniseries Wagner with Richard Burton, and you were able to work alongside one of your heroes. What did Richard Burton teach you about acting and fame?
At that time when I worked with him, his love affair with Elizabeth Taylor was all over the papers. And we were filming in Austria. And Richard Burton was a hero, an acting hero of mine that I'd grown up watching. I never thought I'd get to work with him. As it turned out, he was an incredibly articulate, learned, well-read man who was really destroyed by alcohol. He was 57, 58 when he died, but he looked 20 years older. When I got talking to him, he said to me that it's not that when you're famous, you know, you change. Everybody around you changes. That's what people have a problem with, because you're still the same person inside, except everybody is now relating to you in a different way. So I think he said it was a poison drink, that in the beginning you drink it because it tastes really good, and then you need it and you keep drinking it, and then it eventually turns to poison.
On this same series, you also got to work with another one of your heroes, Sir Laurence Olivier. How did that meeting with Olivier go?
Well, again, he was one of my huge heroes. I mean, I'd grown up seeing him in amazing, iconic performances. He was the great, great actor, stage and film actor. So I hadn't really much to do with him, but I was walking in the corridor one day and I saw this elderly man come out of a dressing room. And as I walked towards him, I realized, oh my God, this is Laurence Olivier. And I didn't know what to say, what to do. I couldn't ignore him. I had to say something. So the only thing that came out of my mouth was, excuse me, do you have the time, please? And I thought, Jesus Christ, why did I say that? And he turned to me and he said, are they paying you on this? And I said, yes. And he said, then I suggest you buy a watch.
Whoa.
And I thought, oh my God. And I was like really upset for days afterwards. But people had said to me, you know, he's cantankerous, you better be careful around him and so forth. But one day, just before he was due to finish, I went into my dressing room and there was a note on the table in this beautiful handwriting with black ink. It said, "My dear chap," basically he apologized for being short and being, you know, curt in his reply. He said, "But I have thought about your question. Do I have the time? In response to that, I'd like to quote you lines from a greater mind than mine." And in it, he wrote, I think it was Sonnet 60, which is Shakespeare's sonnet about time. And what he was essentially saying in that was, no, I don't have the time. I do not have time. And time is the most precious thing that we have. Yet my idiotic, stumbling remark to him provoked his thoughts about how much time he had left in his life. And so I have that letter still, and I have it in my office because I was a young man when I met him. And now I truly understand what he means by time.
Yeah. You played the protagonist in the Coen brothers' 1990 neo-noir gangster movie, Miller's Crossing. What do you remember most about working on that film?
Well, that the Coens were in their late 20s, I think, when they made that film. And many people say it's one of their best films. And it's stood up remarkably well. It wasn't the most wonderful experience to shoot, but it was tremendously fulfilling in the sense that it was an amazing role for me to get in my first film in America.
I came to hear your side of the story, how horrible Rogue was, how he goaded you into it, how he tried to shake you down.
That's not why you came either.
Tell me why I came.
The oldest reason there is.
No friendlier places to drink.
Why can't you admit it?
Admit what?
Admit you don't like me seeing Leo because you're jealous. Admit that you've got a heart, even though it may be small and feeble, and you can't remember the last time you used it.
If I'd known we were going to cast our feelings into words, I'd have memorized the Song of Solomon.
And it opened the doors critically for me in America to a career, and I never had to audition again, which is a blessed relief. But I'm very proud of that film.
Mm-hmm. And well, you should be. Well, one of the roles you're best known for is playing Dean Keaton in The Usual Suspects. You attended the film's premiere at the Cannes Film Festival. The film was pretty much deemed an instant classic on the spot, but you had a much different reaction to it. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I suppose I had what a lot of people might call a panic attack, in the sense that I saw instantly how the world around me changed in that room. And whereas before I could have walked into that room and not been, you know, noticed one way or the other, really, you know, like apart from some people who might have known me from a couple of films. But this instantly changed everything.
I used to roam dope for him. Too bad he got shipped.
Yeah, I shipped him. Better you hear it from me now than from somebody else later.
I appreciate that. Just out of curiosity, was it business or personal?
A bit of both.
Because of my experience with, you know, with Burton, and because I did not want really to ascend to any other level than what I was, I basically had a panic attack and I left the film festival in the middle of a press conference and I went to a hotel room 50 miles away and locked myself in a room for 3 days.
This reaction to that you had to The Usual Suspects, this seems emblematic of a theme of your memoir about identity and knowing your true self and how acting is a part of that. I'm curious, did writing this memoir offer you any clarity on your own identity?
That's a good question. What I realized is that we all have different identities in the sense that we go through life and we could look at each stage of our lives as an identity. When we're children, then when we're teenagers, when we're young adults, as we get older, these are different forms of identity. But it's the journey towards there that's important.
Mm. Your memoir is so beautifully written. If people didn't know you, this would read like a literary novel. It makes me wonder, is fiction writing next for you?
Yeah, well, I'm working on a novel now. And there's freedom in a novel, you know, because with a memoir, you're confronted on every page with the truth. You say, look, you know, I can leave this out or I can put it in. And I decided to put in all the things that I wanted to leave out. That's kind of how I approached it. Because what was the point of writing a memoir if you weren't going to tell the truth? So with a novel, you have more freedom to hide behind characters and get them to say things that you mightn't be able to say within the context of a memoir. We'll see how it goes. And I'm enjoying being free enough to be able to do it.
Well, I look forward to reading it. And I'm sure many others do, too. Gabriel Byrne, thank you very much.
It's wonderful talking to you. Thank you so much.
Gabriel Byrne is the legendary stage and screen actor known for Miller's Crossing and The Usual Suspects. His memoir is called Walking with Ghosts. Find out more about Gabriel at wpr.org/beta.
It still sounds so current. It sounds so present. Like, even though it's Beethoven, like, it's very old music and it's technology that's 50 years old at this point. It still sounds so fresh and so current.
Wendy Carlos's groundbreaking score for Stanley Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange is just one example of how music explores the idea of gender fluidity. So says writer Sasha Geffen. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.